God's kingdom. There's a copy over there for you to have a look at later on if you'd like. He says, this willingness to argue on the basis of historical events which are open to independent investigation is one of the unique features of Christianity. This is both the strength and the vulnerability of Christianity. It invites people to consider its claims critically and allows itself to be dismissed if it is found not to be true. So what I'd like to do in the first section of this talk is to spend just a little while responding to the objections. Because the Christian claim that Jesus rose from the dead, it's a claim that's been objected to and doubted from the time it was first claimed right through to today. And it's a claim which, if shown to be false, brings Jesus, Christianity and Christians tumbling down around it, as hopefully you discovered as you've talked with each other. But it's also a claim which, if true, changes everything. For everyone, for all time. I'm not going to be able to answer all the objections, and even on the ones that we do think about tonight, I won't be able to give full conclusive answers to any of them. But what I want to do is just give us some things to think about under each one. Firstly, you'll see it on your handout, the objection that Jesus didn't really die. This has commonly been referred to as the swoon theory. A swoon, not as in a woman swooning over a man's muscular physique, but swoon as in fainting or losing consciousness. What happened, it is claimed, is that Jesus merely passed out on the cross and then later resuscitated or revived in the cool of the tomb, rather than being resurrected, raised from the dead. Well, we can see from the passage that was read out for us that there was no doubt that Jesus died. True, Pilate was surprised to hear that Jesus had already died, verse 44. Surprised because sometimes victims could hang there for two or three days before dying. That was part of the cruelty of crucifixion. But that's why Pilate summons a centurion and checks with him if it really happened. And only after learning that, yes, Jesus has died, does he give Joseph the permission to take the body. To me, it would seem strange, given that we have people as expert in crucifixion as the Romans, and given that we have someone as important at the time as Jesus, it seems strange that his execution would have been muffed in some way. It would also seem strange that someone who had endured something like crucifixion, with bits of flesh missing, blood everywhere, and in need of extreme medical treatment, could have convinced anyone that he'd conquered death and was deserving of worship. But convinced the disciples were. Secondly, if it is acknowledged that Jesus really did die, then perhaps what happened is that his followers went to the wrong tomb. That they went to a tomb that happened to be empty, though it thought it meant that he'd risen from the dead, but the one in which Jesus' body actually lay was elsewhere. That's another possible objection. Well, Mark in his account, he's very clear, isn't he? Because look at what he has here. Chapter 15, verse 40. There are some women watching the events of Jesus' death from a distance. Then he names some of them. We have Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger and of Joseph and Salome. They're there watching Jesus die. Then come down to verse 47. Joseph has made arrangements for Jesus' body to be taken down from the cross and placed in the tomb. And chapter 15, verse 47, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. So there were a number of women who saw Jesus die. Among them were two Marys and Salome. And here the two Marys witness the tomb in which Jesus is placed. Who do we have in chapter 16 coming to the tomb and discovering that it's empty? Chapter 16, verse 1, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome. Mark is very careful and clear, isn't he? There was no confusion over the tomb. The other problem with the wrong tomb theory is, of course, that as soon as Jesus' followers started claiming that it was true that he was alive, the Roman authorities could have easily produced the body. And that would have been the end of that, but they didn't. And they couldn't. Even for the Jews, the issue was not whether the tomb was empty. They were forced to acknowledge that. The issue wasn't whether it was empty, but how it became empty. Thirdly, if Jesus really did die and his followers had gone to the right tomb, perhaps at some point prior to their declaration that he was alive, what happened was that they stole the body out of the tomb. But such an action doesn't really seem to fit what we've seen of Jesus' disciples over the last couple of chapters. Here, for example, the women are downcast, wondering who will roll the stone away from the entrance so they can get in and anoint Jesus' dead body with their spices. The male disciples, they're not even on the scene at the moment because of their cowardice and fear. They've run away. Would they have all of a sudden plucked up the courage to take on a Roman guard, then managed to roll a 2-ton stone away from the entrance and steal away the body? And even if they had stolen the body, would that explain the dramatic change from what they're like here to what they're like shortly after in the book of Acts, boldly declaring that Jesus had indeed risen from the dead? As I said before, it's hard to see how a body that had been crucified could have convinced anybody of anything other than it had been crucified. Well, if Jesus really did die, and it was the right tomb that they went to, and they hadn't stolen the body, perhaps Jesus' followers were hallucinating. That's another objection to Jesus' resurrection. They so desperately wanted him to be alive that his followers, they hallucinated. They imagined that he was actually alive. But the women hearing Mark's account, they seem to be in a pretty reasonable state of mind, don't they? Wondering who will roll the stone away for them so that they can access the tomb. That seems to be a pretty sensible, reasonable thing to be thinking. The psychological principles that you'd normally see present in instances of hallucinations, they're not present here or in any of the accounts. It doesn't line up with the mental state of Jesus' followers. The fact that we read elsewhere, as Matt read out, of several groups of witnesses also make for problems for the hallucination theory. And again, I'm sure the Roman authorities and the Jewish leaders would have been more than happy to produce Jesus' body to quash any hallucinations that may have been had. Well, finally, someone might object that the evidence we have is all contained in the gospel accounts, like this one in Mark, and you just can't trust them. They're not reliable. Well, that, of course, is part of a far bigger objection for which you need to think through various tests for the reliability of written documents, tests that consider the number of manuscripts that you have and the time interval between the originals and the copies, whether you're dealing with eyewitnesses' account or not, whether other historical material confirms or denies what's written, for all of which, by the way, the Gospels come through with flying colours as ancient documents. But I just mentioned a couple of points to consider on this. One is that if you were fabricating your story, if you were making it up, why would you explicitly choose women as your first witnesses? I know that sounds sexist today, and it would be if it was an argument used in the 21st century rather than in the first. But in the first century, a woman's testimony, it wasn't even admitted in a Jewish court of law. So why would you insist, as Mark and the other three gospel writers insist, that women were the first witnesses of the resurrection? Unless that is actually what happened. Embarrassing and unhelpful for your cause, though it may be. The other point is that if the story was made up, if the gospel writers collaborated and tried to make their story line up with each other, you'd expect to have a far more obvious agreement between the accounts. Instead, what we have is that the four Gospels, they're at their most independent when it comes to the resurrection. I'm not saying they're contradictory, but when you take the time to compare them, it actually takes quite a bit of thought and work to see how they could all be true. It's not as neat and straightforward as you might think it would be, and as neat and straightforward as you think it would be if people were cooking up something between them. And finally, as I've mentioned already, you still have the empty tomb to explain sufficiently. And you still have the transformation in the disciples and the growth of the early church to explain sufficiently. As David Seckham writes again, in the very city where he died, they declared him alive. And the authorities were powerless to contradict them. All Jerusalem knew the grave was empty. And many were convinced by the apostles' account of what had happened. Well, before we move on from the objections, there's space for you to talk amongst yourselves again. Same groups as before. The questions are over the reverse side. What do you think of these objections to Jesus' resurrection? And can you think of any other objections? What do you think of the responses to these objections? And can you think of other responses? I'll give you a few minutes to talk a bit more together, the objections and the responses. Alrighty, let's come back together again. Alrighty. I know I spent a while there trying to respond to some of the objections, but I think that's important to do, particularly in a series like this, The Doubter's Guide to Jesus, but also because it's important just because it's important. If you believe it, you want to be sure why you believe it. And there are various resources that I've listed on your handout. I've put a couple of my copies on the table over there if you want to look into it a little bit more. But what I want to do to finish is to spend some time rejoicing in the narrative. Because what Mark gives us here, it's not primarily a response to objections, a negative purpose. It's something that is to be rejoiced in. It has a far more positive purpose. The truth that Jesus is alive, that's cause for great joy. So let's spend our time that's remaining rejoicing in the narrative. And we start at a point where there's actually nothing much to rejoice in at all. Because having a Christ, a Messiah, a leader who's been crucified, that's an oxymoron. That's a contradiction in terms, and a particularly painful and devastating one at that. Let me pick up the story that Steve read out for us earlier. Mark 15 from verse 40. Some women were watching from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James the younger and of Joseph and Salome. In Galilee, these women had followed him and cared for his needs. Many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem were also there. It was preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath. So as evening approached, Joseph of Arimathea, a prominent member of the council, who was himself waiting for the kingdom of God, went boldly to Pilate and asked for Jesus' body. Pilate was surprised to hear that he was already dead. Summoning the centurion, he asked him if Jesus had already died. When he learned from the centurion that it was so, he gave the body to Joseph. So Joseph bought some linen cloth, took down the body, wrapped it in the linen, and placed it in a tomb cut out of rock. And then he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. In a number of different ways, it's communicated to us that this is a particularly sad and depressing scene. There are women watching from a distance. The 12, Jesus' disciples, out of cowardice and fear, are so at a distance themselves that they're not even on the scene. They're not even in the frame at this point. It falls to Joseph to do something about the body as evening falls, because Jewish custom dictated that a body wasn't to be left out overnight, it was to be buried on the same day. Which, given that Jesus breathed his last at 3 p.m, meant that there wasn't a whole lot of time left. And it's not Jesus' family or his close disciples who make those arrangements, as would be normal, but it falls to Joseph of Arimathea. And what's more, this passage is absolutely littered with references emphasising that Jesus is really, conclusively, definitely dead. Look at how many there are all in a row from the end of verse 43 on. Joseph asks for Jesus' body. Pilate is surprised to hear that Jesus is already dead. He checks with the centurion, asks him if Jesus had already died. Pilate then gives the body to Joseph. So Joseph takes down the body and lays it in a tomb, the place of the dead. Which is why it makes sense that those in the story that we see and hear, why they have not so great expectations. If you've been a Christian for a while, you can be a bit blasé about the fact that Jesus rose from the dead. You've heard it so many times, you're just expecting it. That's what happens. But his first followers back there, they're not expecting anything of the sort. Back on this first morning, none of them were expecting him to rise from the dead. None of them were entertaining such expectations. See from chapter 16, verse 1. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome, bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" These women who'd been watching these events as Jesus died from a distance and who'd seen the tomb in which Joseph laid his body, they come with their spices. Spices that were used to counter the effects of a dead body's decomposition. Perhaps it had been such a rush job that on that tragic afternoon that it hadn't been done yet. Either way, here they come. These women with their spices because they're expecting Jesus' dead body to be in the tomb needing those spices. Not so great expectations. And while they're making their way to the tomb, they're talking to each other and they're discussing, "Won't it be great to see him alive again?" "Oh, don't be silly, Salome. Great's an understatement. It'll be incredible. Oh, I can't wait to hear his voice and feel his touch." That's not what they're saying. They're asking, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" Because they're expecting the stone still to be there. In place. Just as it was the first time they'd been there. Because they're expecting Jesus to still be dead. And his body laying dead inside. A Christ crucified. Not so great expectations. Look how the narrative starts shifting for us from verse 4 onwards. It gets strange before it gets wonderfully glorious. From verse 4. "But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed." Of course they were. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." They needn't have worried about the stone after all. It's been rolled away. And instead of the man they're expecting to see, there's another man. Described by Mark as you would describe an angel, with what can only be described as a remarkable message. And I just want to draw out each part of the message here in verses 6 and 7, just briefly. Because here is the point at which the strange starts giving way to the wonderful. See what the young man says from verse 6, "Don't be alarmed." Because that's exactly what they are. Same word. That's what they need to hear at this point. "You are looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified." That Jesus, the exact same one that we've just been talking about as being dead. Yes, same one. He was crucified. But he has risen. He's been raised. He stands up again once more. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. Have a look for yourself. You saw it, remember? The body you were coming to anoint with spices because it was a dead body, look. It's no longer here because he's risen. "But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." See, the truth of Jesus' resurrection, it sends a powerful message, doesn't it? Firstly and importantly, his word, it can be trusted. Always, even beyond the grave. "You will see him just as he told you." We haven't read the passages, but ever since the disciples recognised who Jesus is, acknowledged that yes, he is the Christ, the Messiah, God's promised one, Jesus had spoken of his death and resurrection. Chapter 8, verse 31. He would suffer and be rejected and killed, and after 3 days rise again. After the Transfiguration, chapter 9, Jesus told Peter, James and John not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. Later in chapter 9, he told them that he would be betrayed, killed, and after 3 days he would rise. Chapter 10, verse 33, again the Son of Man will be betrayed, condemned to death, handed over, mocked, spat on, flogged and killed, and 3 days later he will rise. And chapter 14, after they shared their last meal together and had headed out to the Mount of Olives, Jesus tells them, chapter 14, verse 27, you will all fall away. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. Here the message the women are told and the message there to pass on is, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. See, Jesus' word, it's trustworthy. Secondly, this message from the young man angel, it's also a message of restoration, isn't it? And don't the disciples need that? And doesn't Peter especially need news of that? See, why is Peter singled out here? Isn't it because of the events of that awful night for him? Where he denied his Lord 3 times? And for the other disciples as well, who'd all fled and deserted Jesus, here is a message holding out the hope of restoration. He's going ahead of you. You'll see him. You'll meet him again. The relationship continues. There's a new beginning. A fresh start for you, even after all that you've done. That's powerful. And of course, thirdly, there's also a note of mission sounded in the message, isn't there? Because the word that he's spoken in advance about his death and resurrection, it's come true. So what a word. What a message to share. The one crucified, he's now risen. And despite the failure of his followers, this word, as we've just seen, it brings the message of restoration as well. So what a word. What a message to share with others. Go tell, the young man had told the women. See, this message in verses 6 and 7, it contains so much, doesn't it? The assurance that Jesus' word is trustworthy. That restoration is available. That mission, it's commenced. Which is where the story almost ends, but not quite. Most people, myself included, take verse 8 as the final verse in Mark's Gospel. There are various versions, a short extended ending and a longer extended ending that have floated around. But the style of writing in those endings, they don't match Mark's style. And the most reliable manuscripts that we have don't have those verses. So what I think we're left with is a typically abrupt final verse of Mark, verse 8. He's been abrupt all the way through, hasn't he? It has the effect of asking us a question. What will our response be? His narrative, his story, it's like a story that doesn't end. Verse 8. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. What happened next? Mark, he doesn't tell us, does he? The women's response is completely understandable, of course. But at least at this point, it's not what they've been instructed to do, is it? Go tell, remember? But we associate with them, don't we? We get it. We have sympathy for, we feel for them. And so Mark, with this ending, in effect, he asks us a question. He forces us to consider, what will my response to this Jesus be? What happens next for me, the reader? the one that I've seen to be crucified and yet now am confronted with his empty tomb and this message that he has risen. What is your response to Jesus? There is no more important question to answer, is there? How about I give you a moment to personally reflect on that, and then we'll break into our groups again. Questions on the back of your handout. What is your response to Jesus? I'll give you a minute or two. All right. Well, before we sing again, I'll get you just to move into those groups again. The last question is on your handout. The young man's message demonstrated that Jesus' word was trustworthy, restoration was available, and mission had commenced. In what ways is this still a message that we need to hear today? I'll give you a couple of minutes to chat and then we'll sing again to finish. Bring those chats to a close and continue them over supper.